Welcome to Discovery 1, Module 8. Before I get started, I have a couple of announcements to make. The first announcement being, for those of you who are not listening on the lecture today and happen to pull the recording down in time, tomorrow at 1 Eastern, 2 Eastern. Yeah, we're going to have to do
I'm going
to
look it up and I'm going to do a time conversion for you.
Because yeah, it's we're 12 Eastern. Hours behind you guys right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
Is she coming in at 2 o'clock?
Yes.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, it's 2 Eastern.
So anybody who can be there, and we realise that it's an absolutely crocker time for anybody to be there, so if you can't, that's okay. If you're working the next day, that's okay. But the fact is that the more people we can have on, the more likely that Cisco will fund us for the next 6 months. So if you can possibly be there, please be there. You will have the satisfaction of knowing that you have helped us get more money and the Academy to continue. So if anybody can be there at that particular time range, we would really appreciate it. We are going to do some emailing and actually get some people in at the association here too, so that we've also got some backsides on seats and stuff. So please, if you can be there at that horrific time, that would be really great. If you can't, well, we understand, but yeah, see what people can do. Okay.
What time is that for time,
I'm sorry?
What I'm sorry, we couldn't hear that.
What time is that
for I still can't hear you, whoever you are. You are really, really faint. Okay. Now, who was... Oh, what time is it Perth time? 2 p.m. Perth time. I can hear doorbell sounds, and I can hear eloquence. Okay. Now, the second announcement I have to make this morning before we get started... And this goes for most of you who are on here are exempt from this announcement, but this is for people who are listening to the recordings. We are now at Module 8. We are now at Module 8. We only have another module to go and then the final exams before we finish Discovery. If you have not submitted your labs, now would be a good time to get started. I can say that with underlines, italics, and really big letters. I should be seeing modules for Chapter 5, Chapter 6... from most students, and this is not always the case. The other thing that we need to advertise is that for the person who has finished all of their labs by, what was it,
July
15, you will go in the draw to win a mystery technical prize, and there is one prize for Discovery. And there is one prize for ITE. And we're going to make sure that one person doesn't win both prizes, so you won't get that lucky. But you could go in the draw to win a techie prize. It might be a wireless card. It might be a USB sound card. It might be, it might be anything. You won't know what it is.
It could not be out yet. We don't know.
That's right. But if you get all of your labs done by July 15, you go in the random draw for a free techie prize that we will post to you. And that's just to get people, just give people a little bit of incentive to work on their labs. We know that it can sometimes be difficult to put the time aside for the labs, and we realise that we are a capitalistic society, so here's a carrot. Okay, the next point that I was going to make is that it is possible for you to obtain audio answers for questions after you have done the exam. Or you can organise a time for Grace and I to go through your exam with you, and we will tell you what you got right and what you got wrong. And we did that this morning for Stacey, and we think she's still okay. She survived. We went through her Chapter 3 with her, and she's a little bit wiser. we're happy to do that for students who have trouble, who get a low mark. I think I would be setting, if you get above 80, we probably don't want to hear from you, okay? So if you're below 80%, we're quite happy to go through the exam answers, time permitting, for your exam and tell you what you got right and what you got wrong and what the right answers were. Any questions, comments, queries?
Yeah, I just want to say sorry for getting a tad behind in the labs. Again, my computer exploded, as Jim might have mentioned a time or again.
Don't apologize. Just start going at them when you can.
Yeah, I'll probably get to them tomorrow. Probably. Maybe Thursday. Who knows? But yeah, soon.
Yeah, look, to be honest, we don't really care what your excuses are, we just want you to do your labs, okay? So, yeah.
And if you're an ITE person listening to the recording, I will, because Stacey just said, I go over the exams with you as well if you need it. And I've got Carrie's cred, so if he's busy doing something, I can definitely help you as well.
But if you'd like my personalized exam feedback, you can ring me up and I can talk you through your exam. Okay, so let us know if you need help. If you have any questions, if you have any queries, then you can email caviinstructors@gots.net or you can post to the mailing lists. We don't bite, we only nibble. Okay, so if you have any questions, please use the mailing lists. If anything is confusing you, if you're stressed out about anything, and it happens to be technical in nature, we don't provide a counselling service, you can certainly get in touch with us and we will help you. We can even help you making study plans and stuff if that's something you need. But if you're just lazy and don't ever get to the labs, we can't really do much for you and we're sorry about that. We do understand that sometimes people get really, really busy and they don't get to the labs. Can you just let us know or something that you might be looking at them before the end of the course so that we don't have to put zero in your lab marks? Because once we put zero in your lab marks and near the 30th of July, there isn't a lot we can do. So just keep that in mind. Anyone got any questions, queries, anything that's worrying anybody about the course at the moment? Anything that people are having trouble with? Are we too difficult to get hold of? Are we, anything that...
Is there any chance that you could help me privately with Chapter 3 labs? Some Chapter 3 and 4?
We'll see what we can do.
What do you need help with? Do you need help knowing what you need to do with the labs, or...?
Well, with Chapter 4, pretty much the one after the trace route labs. The one after
okay,
the trace route. Chapter 3,
write
the first one where you have to draw a peer-to-peer, design a peer-to-peer network diagram, and I think there are two labs for that in
you
Chapter
draw
3.
It, just build it.
And then in 6, there's
just
a bunch of...
Okay. If it says draw a diagram, we want you to write up a description for it. So you would explain what was connected to what, rather than drawing a diagram. We do not expect blind people to draw diagrams, because they don't tend to do it very well. Okay? Even with crayons and big paper.
For 4, Module 4, after that lab... All you're going to do is write up a couple paragraph description of how you would build a cable and how you would test a cable, and that is after you do the trace route lab, and that little description passes you for 4.
And to get the information for that cable making lab, you listen to the cable making demonstrations, preferably 2007. We go through it in excruciating detail. Is that how everybody else did that cable making lab? I've seen answers from
yes.
Stacey, I believe. Did you all just listen to that 2007 and listen to us all go through it and go, oh, well, that's how they did it, crunch, crunch? Because it is quite descriptive, that recording, and you can hear what everybody's doing, and we do try and talk you through the whole process. Ian does a pretty good job at that.
Now, what about the labs for Chapter 6, the ones before 6.4?
We'll take a look at those. And we'll get back to you on those ones. Basically, we will we'll see what we can do. We do have... there is no need to use a visual traceroute tool. So when you're doing the traceroute lab for Module 4, do not try and find a visual traceroute tool, although I think Stacey did manage to find one. I think it was Stacey that managed to find one. I have to go and have a look at it now because I hadn't known that there are any accessible. We don't tend to focus on the visual traceroute tools too much, so don't waste time finding that. Ah, it wasn't you. It must have been Melanie. Melanie found one, I think. Oh, look, I'll just blame somebody randomly. It was next-door neighbor's dog that found one, okay?
And what about for Chapter 7 also? Because I haven't been able to do the labs in that one.
Just made it.
Chapter 7, you would write down the procedure for changing your SSID and stuff on your wireless network stuff. And if you don't know how to do that, then you'll have to figure out how you would do that. on your own equipment and write down what you actually did to change the...
There's only one problem. I don't have access to that equipment.
Do you know what kind of equipment it is?
It's through the cable company, and they... And it's set up in an area where I don't have access to it.
If you can get someone to just read you the model name, the model number and brand of the router, then you can look up what the procedure is on the internet, probably.
Otherwise, the academy. Okay. Otherwise, the academy that you are studying Discovery 2 through should have some links, this wireless gear that they might let you configure. You could ask them about that.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'll have to ask them about that. I'll do that.
We do have remotely accessible, reconfigurable wireless gear, but unfortunately it requires OpenVPN to be configured to do that, and under Windows 7 that's a pain in the backside, so we're not rolling that out to students at the moment.
Okay.
I've got a question about them.
Yep.
I've got a question about the material. Is it, how much of it's Cisco specific, or is it all industry generic?
Most of this is industry generic.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Most of it is generic. Whilst we tend to use Linksys gear, because that tends to be the home gear that Cisco sells, so that's the one stuff we tend to focus on. But in modules one, Discovery 1 and Discovery 2, which are the first two modules of the Discovery curriculum, it is all industry neutral. We are not going to teach you how to configure D-Link gear that will blow up and kill the aforementioned neighbor's dog. We are not going to tell you how to configure Netgear gear that will blow up and flatten the neighbor's cat, but you should be able to apply the skills that you gain from this course to any network gear that you are using. With a note that not all Netgear and D-Link gear does blow up and destroy your pets.
Okay, thank you.
My D-Link hasn't blown up yet.
Give it time.
It will.
I had a beautiful...
Okay.
I was sitting there peacefully. Well, it might not. You might be lucky. I was fitting there... Yeah, okay, we can't help you with your two-wire, Drew. That's just something that you're going to have to deal with on a personal level, okay?
I don't have one. People all over this complex have two-wire, and I pity them.
Well, I was sitting there peacefully, like in the house, as peacefully as you can be, at the dining room table, and all of a sudden I heard this incredible... And I'm like, whoa, what was that? And I wandered down, and basically there was a big cloud of smoke above the switch power supply, and half my network was inaccessible. Thank you, D-Link.
Dub an explosion sound on the recording.
At least I'll know now. I'll be waiting for it.
Well, it may not happen. They may have actually tidied up their power supplies. This was a couple of years ago. But yeah, some of the switch modes and stuff they used to ship out were pretty shoddy, and they did occasionally go pop. And I've heard of people having the Netgear supplies go pop as well. So something to be aware of. They usually replace them for you. Now, did you have a question? I think somebody else had a question too.
No question here.
Oh, that's good. We like that.
Oh, well, I've got a question. D-Link, is that anything to do with the data link layer?
No, it's... It probably is why they call it D-Link, actually. I think it's meant to be sort of a pun on data link. But we get a lot of D-Link gear over here in Australia. They tend to sell a lot of it at Dick Smith's. They sell a lot of it cheap in America as well. It's mass-produced. It works well enough. There are some quite good models that do run Linux and stuff and do behave fairly well. But just make sure you've got warranties and stuff on it so that you can get it replaced and stuff.
I gotta tell you, mine's about 4 years. Yeah, I've had about 4 years, and I like the interface. I think the interface is real user-friendly.
Yeah, some of them are, and some of them are absolutely horrific. And in fact, depending from one firmware version to the next, you can actually have an interface that's usable and one that continuously refreshes with your screen reader of choice, and that can be firmware version specific, so watch out for that as well. Sometimes the auto-refreshing status pages and stuff can be a bit of a pain to navigate.
Can you usually turn auto-refresh off on the screen reader?
You can, and that does solve it to a large degree, although there are some pages that actually require the refreshes to actually take place for things to function properly, and they're a bit nasty. There are also some routers that have some very badly labelled graphics and stuff, so you get like image 1, image 2, image 3, image 4, image 5 for your nav bar, and you've basically got to figure out what they all are and figure out where they take you. So, and there's no real easy way to know which routers are going to do that to you until you actually either have a look at the interface to them, or you speak to other blind people who say don't get, you know, model Zizzy. All right, any other questions before we get on to Module 8? Grace is giving next week's lecture, I believe, on customer service. So just so that you guys are all aware that it won't sound like me next week, although I'll probably be interjecting from time to time. Okay, Module 8 talks about security. Security is important because personal information is transmitted over the internet. Can anybody give me an example of the sort of personal information that is transmitted over the internet?
Credit card
banking
numbers.
Information.
Yes, banking and credit card information, passwords, credit card stuff, I said that. How about things like, you know, I suppose, you know, that'd be under PayPal information. For example, PayPal information is another thing you probably don't want to be handing out to everyone. Personal details, yes. Another one that is also becoming...
For security.
I think the other thing is that... sometimes email can be quite personal. What can happen is that you can send a message to a friend. Actually, there was an interesting case recently. A guy phoned into work and claimed he was sick, and told his boss that he was incredibly sick and that he'd be back to work tomorrow. Yada, 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 and then he went and posted on Facebook going, yay, enjoying a lazy sick day. He didn't have a job.
Idiot.
That's what you get, Frank.
Pretty much. But you do have to be careful. I had an incident a couple of years ago where I posted a link to my blog that talked about a health update on my ex-wife, and below that was an entry that I hadn't marked private that was perhaps a bit more revealing than it should have been, and I was informed that that wasn't a cool thing to be pointing people at. So you do have to be careful what information you disclose on the internet and who sees that information. It's all really, really tedious. Why people can't draw the line between corporate and personal is beyond me. But they don't, and you do have to be aware and careful of that sort of thing. So just be aware of information leakage. And, I mean, it does sort of tie into this module because unscrupulous people can get hold of information that you have put up, and they can make that information public, and that can cause you some grief in your professional life and stuff.
I have two birth dates, the real one and one I use over the internet because I want to avoid identity theft. Is that a wise idea?
I don't see what having a fake date of birth is probably going to do for you because nothing that I know is keyed on the date of birth. The problem is that there is circumstances where you need to provide accurate information. And I know, for example, a lot of the people have the practice of providing fake information for domain registrations. That is actually against ICANN policy. And if they actually find you doing it, they can actually take the domains off you. So just be aware of that. What you do usually need to do is use a Whois shielding service to stop spammers from getting hold of your actual information. Then you actually put the actual information in with the registrar. I think the other thing that would be worth keeping in mind is that it's always good to have a couple of chuck-away email addresses. For example, a Hotmail or a Gmail or something, because a lot of websites want your email, and then they will spam you off the face of the planet once you've fed your email address in. So I would recommend having a couple of email addresses. For example, I know Grace does a whole lot of surveys, and she's got a matrix mail address that she uses for all of her survey stuff. So, you know, each to their own. The other thing I have a habit of doing is when a commercial entity asks me for an email address, if I'm bothered, I actually append a suffix. So, say, for example, our television station, Channel 7, asked me for an email address, I would say, oh, my email address is kh-channel7@. And then, if they hand the email address on, you'll know they did it. Okay. Anybody else got any techniques they use for identity protection stuff on the internet that they find is useful?
I have 3 different email addresses.
That always helps.
I've got 5.
I've lost count of how many I've got. Yes, Curtis.
What I do is after you finish, like if you're doing a shopping online, it's always a good idea to make sure you close that site right then and don't leave it open. I've learned that as a good way too.
I'd agree with that completely. Everybody's aware of like referrer cookies and stuff that can see where you've come from and where you're going to. Often if you key in the wrong URL and it says find sites on gambling, whatever, I actually tend to close those browsers down because you don't know what cookies and stuff, session cookies it's populated you with, and it's best to open a completely new browser and go back and go where you wanted to go, because that way it's not going to track where you went off to and that sort of thing.
It's another thing that NoScript is quite useful for, because if you go on, if you're, say, buying groceries or something off the internet, or buying anything really, then you can just allow the website that you're buying from, and then there can be like, you know, there can be like 5 or 6 different other sites that want to, you know, push down scripts or cookies or whatever, and you can just block those.
I have a question. How would I go about blocking like a lot of this spam that's been coming through my email? I mean, I keep getting a lot of spam in my email, and I'm using Gmail, but it. Yeah, I use Gmail.
Oh, really? You get spam in your inbox? I very rarely get Gmail spam. I mean, I get spam, but it all gets filtered into spam.
What you want to do is, just mark it as spam on the webmail if you can be bothered.
Oh, that's a pain.
Does
that stop you from getting more?
Have you been feeding your Gmail address into? Have you been feeding your Gmail address into unscrupulous sites? Because that'll tend to generate a lot of spam. Because generally the spam filters on Gmail are pretty good.
Has someone else been feeding your email into unscrupulous?
Well, some of the stuff like PC, digital TV, and stuff, I haven't even gone to, and somebody has gotten a hold of my email address, and I don't know how to get all that stuff out of there.
Yeah, people sell.
Mark it as spam.
Yeah.
But they're saying that's not easy to do on the website. Can you do it with Firefox, or...?
You can do it with Thunderbird.
Yeah, you can do it with Thunderbird, I should say.
Yeah, and I think you can do it with Outlook Express. Maybe I'm wrong.
No.
You can't do it with Outlook Express.
Okay.
The problem is that a lot of these sites do have unsubscribe links that work, and it can also help to actually use those and see if you can actually take yourself off a number of lists. I've had to do that.
Anyone that says, thank you for clicking unsubscribe, we will take you off in 72 hours, is lying to you.
No, I've actually had some that do, to be honest.
Oh, really? I had no idea it took 3 days to unsubscribe someone from an email.
Oh, it can take 7 to 10.
Yeah, it can.
They just do a big purge once every week or so.
Or it's actually...
You can also go in and block sender.
Yeah, you can block sender. Although the problem with blocking sender is you end up with a huge sender block list, which means that your email client has to trawl through the 900 senders you just blocked every time a message comes in. And that is eventually going to slow your email program down to a crawl. So if you can actually kill the email at the source, that is a far more efficient thing to do.
Yeah, and how many times do you get the same spam from the same source IP/mail address twice?
Oh, I get it regularly. I mean, they keep asking me to upgrade this, upgrade that, like... MP3 Rocket, and then there was stuff about PC, get PC, digital TV, and then all this stuff, and I mean, I can't seem to get rid of it.
You could always register a different Gmail account and shift everything else across to it, and then don't take the spam with you. That'd be one way of getting rid of it all.
Yeah, I mean, I get a lot of spam too on my Gmail, but I never see any of it. It never goes into my inbox. It just goes right into the spam folder. I mean, I'll see like one or two couple of months maybe, but yeah. And if I go into my spam filter, it's full of really frightening
No, I haven't like, heard not of even English. Com. No. There is stuff like Spam Fighter, but I haven't used it, and there is stuff called Zero Spam, and I haven't used that either. So you could try either of those services, but I don't know whether they cost money, and I don't know how accessible they are. Seriously?
Is MailWasher still around, or is that like deprecated?
I just don't understand why you'd be getting so much spam in your Gmail. That just seems really, really unusual. And if you can figure out how to market as spam, that will tend to make it go away in future. Otherwise, try the unsubscribe links. Otherwise, also be careful where you feed your email address in. Yeah, I think no spam is an Exchange plugin, though.
Yeah, I think it is.
So is, there's another one. Mime Sweeper, which is a pretty funny pun.
Also, and I don't think this is what's happened to Paul, but there are various websites that basically the entire purpose of it is to put somebody who you don't like's email address in, and then they will sign that person's email address up to a whole bunch of spam services and then flood their boxes. So some people are not very nice.
Oh, you're not very nice. Oops, did I say that?
I have never. Gosh. Thank you. How dare you?
Sorcerer of Milk.
Yes, how dare somebody? How somebody dare say that I'm not nice? Okay. Okay.
No, you're plenty nice.
And that wasn't Grace, and nobody was talking to you. Let's move on. okay. Now let's get on with the lecture, shall we? Okie dokie. So, no, we don't have a solution for Paul's personal spam problem. However, there is a Thursday chat on spam, so go grab that down and have a listen. That might have some ideas for you as well. We did one, I think, last year or the year before. So grab that one and have a listen. Now, network intrusion is a real threat. Do I need to explain this, really? Okay, it's a real threat. If you have your credit card numbers stolen, if you have your banking details stolen, if you have anything stolen, actually, come to think of it. Now, here's a question. How many people have got all the serial numbers and stuff of their computer equipment written down? Just in case anything goes missing. Very handy thing to do, especially for the insurance company. But has everybody done that?
No.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's a good idea on braille labels under the desk. Yeah, that's another way of doing it. A very good idea, just so that you can keep track of stuff, and if it turns up at cashies, you can... Well, you know, guys don't have cash converters. If it turns up at the Hawk shop, you can actually, you know, register the serial numbers, and you've got, like, a very slim chance of seeing the stuff again. The other thing I would recommend people take a note of is the IMEIs for their phones, so that if your phone gets stolen, you can block it, and the crook can't then use it. Very handy thing to do.
Most of my equipment's so old, I'll pay them to take it away.
Yeah. Fair enough. so, okay.
How much?
Australian dollars, so it's not worth as much as yours.
Yeah,
alright. Okay, so we're talking about hackers and crackers, okay? Difference between hackers and crackers is hackers are the people that are interested in knowing how systems work, they are interested in knowing how the operating systems function, and they are interested in learning about computers and the way computers and the information systems work. Crackers tend to be destructive people who are interested in the theft of data, the theft of services, etc. We are talking here about things like the black hats and the white hats. Is it the black and the white hats? Yeah, I think it is. The black hats being the evil ones and the white hats being the good ones. What stereotyping, but there you have it. Okay, sorry about that. So you've got good hackers.
The communist hats that are...
And there are communist hats that are red. Okay, good. And then we all do it for the state. Okay, jolly good. Now, the crackers tend to be kids and stuff and people who are interested in espionage. In fact, a lot of the world mafias and stuff now are getting into IT crime, and you can watch some of those terrifying documentaries that tell you how the world is going to come to an end, which is sort of quite possible with all this computer crime, but rather than sort of doing a drive-by shooting, you can just steal somebody's identity and ruin their life and ruin all their money and ruin all their financial stuff and take them out just as successfully as putting some lead in them.
Yeah, it's a pretty open secret that China is constantly attacking America's firearms.
Yeah, I think there. But and there are also a lot of gangs that have actually moved to doing computer stuff. So, I don't know, what is it, you know?
Think about your family before I let go of this script kiddie package I've got here for you.
Okay, I mean, it's a real problem. The mafia is not going out and bashing people. Okay, so you've got hardware threats. If somebody can bust into your building and nick your computers, sadly, that happens. Software threats. You're talking about buffer overflows, errors in software, unpatched vulnerabilities, especially in Microsoft Internet Explorer, although there are a whole pile that show up in Firefox as well. A few in Safari, quite a number in Safari for Windows, and there were a couple in Google Chrome. Keep your stuff patched, keep your stuff up to date. Password guessing threats. If you have your password set to Grace123, somebody might guess it, especially if they're guessing Grace's account. I'll tell you, I got somebody hacked my box the other day because I had a username and password that were set the same. Silly me. It was done for a specific person that was over at my place and to make their life easier, but unfortunately when I logged in, I found a little little kit of software running on one of my servers that had been dropped on by somebody who had succeeded in guessing that username and password. That has now been fixed.
How long have the account been up?
Hey?
How long had that account been made?
Couple of weeks,
yeah.
Wow. Jeez. Just some random person just trolling the internet just randomly found your box and said, hey, I'll try this password.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm not even sure how they got the usernames and stuff. Probably a dictionary attack, but they SSH'd into my box because I did have an open SSH port. I still do, although I am looking at putting up port knocking, which I'll talk about later on in the lecture if I've got time. And somebody managed to guess a username and password. All right, so we did.
How did you know my password was Grace12?
Because I know that, you know, you think very highly of Grace and you guys love talking politics. So yeah, that'll be your password. The other password to ignore is secret love. Sex, your dog's name, your whatever, okay? Try and keep your passwords fairly random. Uppercase, lowercase, numbers if possible, sometimes punctuation depending on the rules. Writing them in Braille is not so cool because there might be people who can read Braille and you can get Braille alphabets off Google, but you can do it if you think that's an advantage. But I recommend a thing called KeePass, which I've talked about before. www.keepass.info. Keep AWS. That's only got one P, hasn't it? KeePass.
I think so.
That's a terrible pun if it's only got one. Okay. Why is Marcus dropping on off? Do you want to go and see what the deal is?
So only use 666 if you actually are the Beast.
And I suppose if you are the Beast, you'll also probably know how to defend yourself against security attacks.
The Beast doesn't even need a user account because she'll just take someone else.
Sometimes what I find is good for passwords, personally, Grace uses a bizarre mix of T9 and hexadecimal crud that I can never remember. So you've got E's replaced with 3's and all sorts of weird stuff. And I tend to take sentences and take the first letter of each word in the sentence, such as, Mary had a little lamb, M-H-A-L-L. Not particularly great, but certainly better than love, sex, or secret.
Or password. My trick for passwords usually is to use a hyphenate word and then use capital letters for different parts of it. Like use capital letters on where you would normally put the hyphenates, and then have numbers have the number be something easily rememberable. Like say the number of letters in the word or the number of characters in the password when you count the numbers. Just sort of depending on which version, which system you want to use. I believe there's also an extension for Firefox where, or maybe it's actually included in Firefox itself, that allows you to basically have a master password that you write for everything, and then you can tell Firefox what all of your passwords are, and then have one master password so that when you're on your home computer, you just type in one password, and Firefox will just automatically fill them in for you.
Provided somebody doesn't crack your Firefox password store, which can be done.
It's not terribly hard.
The other thing to keep in mind is that the other thing I do is I often sort words into alphabetical order. I take all the letters in the word and sort them into alphabetical order and then put bizarre capitalization on them. There are utilities that will guess Windows and Linux passwords. If you're interested in that sort of stuff, you're looking at things like Crack for Unix, or you're looking at things like John the Ripper, I think, will do Windows passwords. And yes, not Jack, but John. So John the Ripper is a utility that will go through and will crack Landman hashes and stuff and get passwords out of them. Crack uses a whole lot of transposition rules and stuff to try all different passwords, and it will try and guess them. Don't also think that because you speak a different language, such as Italian, Spanish, Chinese, or whatever, that you're just going to use a Spanish word. We've all got Spanish dictionaries in our password guessing arsenal. Let me tell you, we've all got Chinese ones, and we've all got Dutch ones, and we've all got German ones. So another language will not keep you safe.
Another system you can use, and actually the Bard website makes you do this, and it's not a bad idea, I suppose, if one of your other secures. You can do stuff like, say, use a regular word, but take all the vowels out, or use a word, but make no, and again, Bard makes you do this one, which is the password can't have any repeated letters, so you can start with a word, but then take all the repeated letters out. It's something you can remember and will not be guessed easily by a dictionary attack.
It's always a case of balancing password complexity against usability. There's no point if your password's got like 6 uppercase letters, 7 lowercase letters, 6 special symbols, and is looks like vaguely comprehensible line noise. Okay, so we've got 4 different threats. We have information theft, which is when somebody nicks off with your information. Identity theft, which is when they pretend to be you, and they go and do transactions and stuff. In fact, I've known a couple of people personally who have had credit card fraud done on them, and that is no fun at all. Whilst you can get the money back through Visa and stuff, it's still an unpleasant thing to have happen to you. Data loss / manipulation. Somebody can just delete your stuff, or they can actually change stuff in your files, and that can be quite difficult, especially if you're relying on those files. And disruption of service, such as things like ping floods, smurf attacks, land, all those sorts of things when they knock you off the internet or whatever for a time. Any questions on
that's
any
another
of that
mafia.
Stuff? Well, it doesn't
that's
always have
thing
to be the mafia. It could be any sort of crime gang that's doing it.
Right, but what I've seen happen is, well, I haven't seen it personally, but I've heard of this happening, which is where someone will get some important website will get an email from someone saying, hey, cybercrime is a serious problem. You know, pay us and we'll protect you from it. And then they're like, oh, you crazy, go away. And then on some seriously important day when they need to be up because they know they're anticipating a lot of traffic, they will suddenly be ping flooded offline forever. And then those same guys will contact them and it's like, see, your website went down. That's a real tragedy. You want to pay us to make sure it never happens again?
Mm-hmm. Well, so there you go. That can certainly happen. The other thing that can happen, and it amazes me how gullible some people are. You get a message. I got one last night. I really should have taken it up straight away. But there was a bloke offering me $100,000 from Nigeria, and all I had to do was give him my address and phone number. I didn't quite get to it, sadly. But, I mean, that would have been really cool. I could have had $100,000. Now, for anybody who hasn't picked up the sarcasm here,
$4.6 million. He's sold.
Well,
that's adjusted for inflation in Australian dollars.
Yeah, thanks for that. The other thing is you can also look at if you're doing... the other thing is you get people that come in and they go, I got a message from the Westpac Bank and they want me to update their account information. And you go, do you bank with Westpac? No, but I got a message from them. Well, I'd be deleting it if I were you. If you don't bank with this bank, why should a message from that bank concern you? But I thought I might have to update my account information. And you sort of go, yeah, I've got a couple of acres of swampland I'd like to like to sell you. But yeah, just be aware of the messages that are coming in and read them. Or at least read the subject lines and delete them if they don't look like something that you should be reading.
Well, they can also send them through your text messages on your cell phone as well. I've had that happen to me. So,
yep, spam text is becoming quite a problem, and some of them are sneaky enough that if you actually reply to them, they will then add you to a database and start charging you because that'll be deemed acceptance of whatever horrible conditions of use they've got.
Which is very annoying for me because I don't want to pay for I don't pay for text messages, so the only ones I get for free are from T-Mobile. So if I get dinged 50 cents just for looking at somebody's spam, and that really pisses me.
Yeah, we don't pay for received text in Australia, and we don't pay for received calls on a mobile. We only pay for sent stuff, so we're lucky in that respect.
Well, that's not fair.
Yes, it is. We love it. We can get people calling us for as many minutes on our phone as we like, and it doesn't cost us anything. We just sit on the phone and talk, and we don't have to pay. Grace was really happy about that when she came over. Internal threats. Internal threats. I'm not talking about the burritos you ate last night. I'm talking about employees that can bust your network. People who know your systems, who can hack the systems. People who can cause havoc because they know how the systems run. And often when employees are fired, they are sent to their desk and supervised while they pick up their personal items, and they are escorted out of the building. So often they know the politics of the organisation, they know which people are gullible even, and they also know what things to do to make these threats a reality. The FBI reckons that there is 70% of cybercrime involves internal threats to organisations, people performing espionage and the like. Not all of these threats are intentional. Go ahead.
Looks like the Melbourne Storm problem was an internal person who'd been fired. You don't fire somebody who knows very, very, very sensitive data.
For those of you who don't know, the Melbourne Storm is a football team, I think, or some sort of team, and they had two sets of books. One was the actual figures, and the other was the figures that they were supposed to be using, and apparently they were out by a couple of $1 million, and they basically got completely discredited and lost any of the points they'd picked up and stuff. So that's one of our sporty things over here.
This one from the Sad But True file. A psychology professor from, I can't remember where, but some huge college, it was like Cambridge or Yale or one of these things, was taken in by a 419 heaters, or 419s. Very, very depressed.
Yeah, so,
a 409 scanner, the Nigerian email.
Ah, yes, the 409 scanner. That is, so we just had somebody walk in and saying hello to everybody, which is fine, but we're in the middle of a lecture. And I don't think our lecture sign is stuck to our door. Yeah, those 409 Nigerian scams are particularly nasty. And in fact, there are people who've gone over to try and get their money back, and they've actually been shot. And let me say that puts your, it certainly puts a dampener on the things that you might be doing.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to... But over there, it really is no joke.
Oh, pretty much. And there's some pretty nasty people out there. The other thing to keep in mind is think medical records. How would you like it if all of your medical records got stolen and distributed and stuff? And that's why a lot of people have these problems with online databases and stuff. And the medical records are quite sensitive, and people feel very passionate about their medical records. But even your television watching preferences networks, or if you're a modern kid of the 2000s, your torrenting records can tell a lot of people about what television you're watching and what shows you are seeing.
I've actually heard that somebody's autopsy records got autopsy photos got published onto a public torrent site.
That's not particularly cool. And I'm sure that the family wouldn't be too happy about that.
The family was pissed, and they didn't
that's
take
totally
it down.
Unscrupulous.
Yeah, it is a problem. The other thing
that was not cool.
The other thing to keep in mind is that once information is out there, it's very difficult to put it back in the bottle. And in fact, what a lot of movie companies have been doing, just out of interest, is they have actually been watching trackers and snarfing the IP addresses of people who are downloading these popular movies and things, and then you get a note from the DMCA, say, desist or we will come and see you. So certainly information that's being disclosed, a lot of people aren't aware of the information that is disclosed about them. For example, one of the things that is useful as far as spam tracking is concerned, but is also a disclosure of information, is whenever you send a message through Hotmail, it has your IP address in the headers. They actually have an X-originating IP header that has your IP address.
A lot of them do. Yeah, it's... I've read up a fair amount about this. It's usually not the industry people, but it's more like people that the industry pays to watch them, and they're not particularly accurate. I remember once there was a study done where some college managed to get a whole bunch of DMCA takedown notices sent to what was in fact a printer.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. However, it is something that you should be somewhat concerned about. There is sometimes a case where these threats can be legitimate and they can take action. Although in an interesting landmark court case in Australia, the ISPs actually won a case where they said, no, it's up to you, DMCA, to do the chasing. It is not up to us to chase down these people. We are not going to police them, and we are not going... We will forge your letters on, but that's all we're doing, unless we have court documents to cut off the internet access or whatever.
Well,
on the other hand, then there's Virgin Media.
I want to say something to add to this. I think that's what in my case has happened with me. I mean, my fellow roommate, he was downloading stuff, and that's how come the letters got to our house.
I think
they tracked his torrent.
Yeah, I think the other problem is, though, that you have to decide whose name the internet account is in, and whoever's name that internet account is in, that person is responsible for that internet account. There is no such thing as a shared internet account. It has to be in somebody's name. And it's important for the responsible person on any internet account, I'm not just talking about your situation, I'm talking about anybody's internet account, to take means to stop other people from abusing that internet account. Now, say for example, there are shared house situations and stuff, but you do, the point of responsibility as far as the law is concerned is on the person who owns that internet account, and that person is responsible for making sure that other people don't misbehave. Not fair, but there you have it.
Oh, okay, thank
you. Yeah, I remember...
Thank you.
One time I had a friend over, and she was, like, from way far away, so she's, like, barely over at all. And when she was over at my house, she was using my internet connection to, try and... It wasn't exactly a particularly brilliant hack. She was basically just refreshing the page, but still to, like, vote 18 million times on some poll about who would appear on some comedy special she wanted to watch. And I got very irritated at her for this.
Yeah, and... Yeah, it is a problem. You do have to have some sort of control over what happens on your internet connection, and that'd be quite difficult to do. We actually shared our internet connection with our neighbour, and when we actually had a slower internet connection, the fact that she used to play Farmville used to cause havoc with response times on our internet connection. So a lot of it is social engineering, and some of it is technical stuff as well. Okay, external threats. They usually come in via wireless. Wireless is a big one, especially if keys aren't secure or the keys have leaked or somebody's hacked the keys. Dial-up connections or remote connections into the organization. You also have your social engineering and phishing attack. You ring up people and you talk to them and you work on... getting information from them. This was actually very popular back in the early 80s, back in the freaking scene, which is the phone hacking stuff. You would actually ring up like the exchange operators and you would ask them for various things like the exchange code, and you would say that you were a technician who had lost that information and that you needed to do some work on such and such. And often you could get lots of information about the phone systems from operators who didn't know better not to disclose that information. Don't forget phishing is spelt with a PH because it's a phone attack. PH for phone, and that's phishing, where they try and get information out of you. And there's also vishing, which is where they muck with voice over IP and they also try to get information from you. Pretexting, you pretend to be someone else.
I believe most of the phone calls you get that are press 1 to be connected to a person to blah 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 are voice over IP numbers. They're posing as telemarketers, but they're actually, it's actually sort of a variant on the 409.
Well, we actually get some calls, sometimes we get some calls in, and usually they come up as number unknown, and you answer the phone, and it's like, "Hi, you just won a wonderful cruise for four in the Caribbean! Press one!" Usually, by the time they've said Caribbean, I've hung up.
I'm whooping in delight because I've gone to the Caribbean. I don't know why you're so cynical.
Yeah, well, can't imagine why, huh? The other thing that they do is they say provide your username or your email address or bad things, TM, will happen. That's what I wrote in my notes. They'll ask you for your username and sometimes they'll ask you for the password. I'm doing maintenance on your computer. I need your password. Which makes me make a mental note. I've got to change the password on my workstation today. And sometimes people, they give their password. They just, oh, it's blah. But you've got to make sure that you trust the people. And generally, if I'm doing on-site work and stuff, I actually get people to type in their own password for me so I don't have to know what it is. But to be honest, I can't be bothered remembering everybody's password because it's just a waste of brain space. But, you know, you do have to give people their security. Vishing, you can also have ones that actually redirect calls in such a way that the user thinks that they're talking to their actual phone bank, but they're not. And basically what happens is the bank account details go through, and then once they've got your bank account details, it's all good. They log into the actual phone banking site, and they then nick all your money. Okay, any questions on any of that so far? No questions. Okay. Anybody want to tell me what the difference between virus, worms, and Trojan horses are? Let's see if anybody knows. You can do one each if you want, or something. You can fight it out. Here we go.
A virus is an attack that's passed from computer to computer, and sometimes it's not very harmful. It just pops up a message. Another time it wipes out data. A really harmful virus is a good thing because it tends to wipe itself out.
Well, I don't know whether a really harmful virus is a good thing unless you've got backups. It's certainly not a good thing unless you've got backups. But the key with a virus is that it attaches itself to a program and it has to be activated by the user, by somebody opening an email message or something. And in fact, one of my friends... Drew has mic'd up here. He's obviously got something to say, but I'm going to keep talking because I haven't finished yet. Because it loops me back, you see, and I'll let go of the button in a minute and you can say what it is that you have to say. One of my friends got one of those emails from Facebook that said, "Your account details are incorrect. Please click here to change the password." And when he opened the email, he got virused. Okay, off you go.
Yeah, I don't know why I was staying up, because I actually didn't mean to be queued up for all that time. Hopefully nothing embarrassing comes out of the recording. I was just going to say that a Trojan is usually something that is trying to find an opening in, or create an opening in a firewall, and typically that is to download something else or to spy on you for the benefit of a third party. So usually Trojans are more subtle, and whereas viruses and worms are meant more for destructiveness and to just wipe out things and corrupt hardware and just more destructive.
Kind of. Trojans are actually a program hiding inside another program. Everybody remember the story of Helen of Troy, and they wanted to get into Troy and they couldn't figure out how they were going to get into it, so they put this big wooden horse with five blokes outside the city walls, and it was a present from the gods, and then the people from the city of Troy wheeled the horse inside, and then when they all went snoozy snoozy, the five blokes jumped out of the horse, opened the city gates, and everybody came pouring into the city, and the city of Troy was quite a mess afterwards. So they tricked the Trojans, who were the people who lived in Troy, into wheeling the big horse into the city.
For a more in-depth historical account, you can watch the movie, which is accurate in all ways.
I have no idea, but you could probably also look it up on Wikipedia, which might not be accurate, but it might give you a good idea of the story. It's one of the Greek legends, I think?
Yes.
Hold well, on. It might be Greek, but it's actually only in the Latin text about the founding of Rome. It's not in the Odyssey or the Iliad.
No, certainly not in the Odyssey or the Iliad, but it is in the other texts, so there you go. But you can look all those sorts of things up, and as a matter of fact, I think Project Gutenberg has copies of both the Odyssey and the Iliad in case you want to look it up and see if Jonathan's right, which I think he is, but you could check for yourself if you really wanted to. Okay, Trojan. That is a program that... that, yes, as I said, hooks into another program and pretends to do other things while it downloads stuff, and it pretends to be useful. The other thing I should probably mention on lecture here is we are looking at, just as a general mention, Illyria, not Illyria, it's now called Daisy Worm. It's a Daisy player for the iPhone, so if people want to beta test that, they can get in touch with us via the instructor alias. We need people who are going to provide feedback, so if you have an iPhone, or you know somebody who has an iPhone who will provide useful beta feedback, we are looking at starting, Kieran's looking at starting beta testing in a bit under a week for a Daisy player for your iPhone. Alright, everybody, and a worm is a freestanding program that bounces around between lots and lots of computers, and it is actually... jumps around and infects things. There was a Senmail worm that was quite popular, and there are a whole lot of other worms that are actually freestanding bits of code that cause havoc. Sorry, did somebody want to say something?
Well, I just want to say that don't worms usually replicate? Don't they usually replicate also?
Worms and viruses replicate.
Right, and the difference is that worms can be planted into your system and they don't need to be activated.
That's correct. Now, viruses can travel around between... They can travel across networks. They can travel through flash drives. In fact, they often do travel on flash drives. Guess what, people? Turning off auto-run on your flash drives is probably a good idea. It's kind of handy if you've got a flash drive that you jam in and it loads your screen reader of choice, such as NVDA or Windows. However, auto-runs means that other nasties can run, and sometimes you can get infected by flash drives that contain various viruses. And they do. They go everywhere, all over the place. There are a number of ways of disabling auto-run. I find that smashing it out in the registry is the best way. But you can actually turn off auto-run for all removable media.
And I think Windows 7 includes a feature, a security feature. It automatically disables auto-run for flash drives.
Anybody else confirm or deny this supposition?
Not by default. It's possible that you can turn it off easier. What I have noticed, though, and that's rather confusing for me, is what I used to do to bypass auto run would be to go into the run box and then type in the drive letter. But now, if you do that, it executes whatever program you're going to do, which is the exact opposite of what I'm trying to do when I run that, so that can be kind of confusing. But it's still possible to bypass auto-run even if you have auto-run on. You basically just target the drive you want to open, do the applications, and then go to open as opposed to run program.
U3 will... it will not... If you have U3 going, you can't... you don't. It's not automatically disabled.
Yeah, I don't have... I'm kind of confused, actually, because it said it was a U3 smart drive, and I was all ready to get rid of it, but it's never come up, so I don't know.
You can tell if it's a U3 drive, because it'll usually have two petitions on it, one being for the
yeah,
U3.
It
if you've repetitioned it, though, you'll have smashed the U3.
Yeah, I didn't have to, and it seems to only come up for one, so that's good, because I had some trouble with it, with one, when I was trying to do a bard, so, yeah. I'm glad that it isn't.
Okay. Denial of services or brute force attacks. This is where we're talking about the ping flooding, the Smurf attacks, where you actually load systems down with so much traffic that they can't do anything about it. And there's not really any protection against those attacks. Even if the router does drop all the incoming ping packets that get sent from a ping flood, it may stop your actual internal LAN from being flooded, but your external internet bandwidth will still be very low slash non-existent. Denial of service or a DOS attack is what they're also called. There's also a DDoS, which is a distributed denial of service attack, which is where you get whole piles of PCs, usually botnets they're called, or zombie PCs that go and attack a website and take it down. And we've got flood pings, WinNuke, Smurf, all those sorts of things. Brute force attack is where you've got a fast computer that a user uses to guess codes or crack keys. There are some legitimate uses of this, such as the RC564 project, SETI at home, if you're looking for search for extraterrestrial intelligence, all that sort of stuff. They are programs that are legitimate uses of lots of computer time. But there are some programs that will actually use your computer to crack passwords and stuff if you are not careful.
Sorry, can you explain DDoS again, please?
A distributed denial of service attack is where you infect lots and lots and lots of computers with your bot code, and then at a predetermined time or whatever, these computers then go off and all attack Facebook at once.
Thank you.
Spyware, which is stuff that watches what you're doing, tracking cookies, and adware. Does anybody remember that horrible Gator toolbar that was around a few years ago?
Only too well. That was insipid. It was worse. Oh, it wasn't worse than... Does anyone remember Cool Web Search? Because that was really bad. But Gator was... Oh my... And then it became Gain. Oh, that was the bane of my existence. It came with everything.
I mean, I personally find the fact that CCleaner comes with a Yahoo toolbar a bit tedious, unless you get the light version.
Yeah.
I remember sort of having my browser and trying to go to my banking site and hearing this thunk noise, which sounded like somebody, I don't know, dropping a something into a bucket. And I sort of went,
I know it was famous for that one, too.
That's the Yahoo toolbar, and luckily there's an add remove programs on the Yahoo toolbar now, so you can go and uninstall it. And there is for the Google toolbar and various other toolbars, but you have to watch out because Windows Live Messenger and stuff insists on setting Bing to be your default search engine and installing a whole lot of stuff that you don't want, and AVG Free by default will install a security toolbar which you may or may not want.
This is why all cool people use Miranda.
Says him, but the actual necessary steps to get Miranda up and talking are quite tedious, especially when you've got to get MirrorSpeak running as an administrator. So, yeah, the cool people might use Miranda, but it certainly requires a lot of setup.
Cool people use administrator.
Yeah, that's not... Yeah, out of... The administrator thing is just because it comes with runtimes that... Or it asks for runtimes that I apparently suck at finding, so I think that's just my problem.
Andre Louis has a URL where he keeps his latest configured Miranda, though. So, yeah.
You were super quiet.
Anyone cares?
She'll probably normalize up once we normalize the recording up, but Andre Louis has an Andre Louis customized Miranda. And if you trust Andre Louis, you can get his customized Miranda, and it should work. I'm going to build my own Miranda personally because at least I'll know what has been done to it to make it go. That's better.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is an option. You can get a pre-configured Miranda that will have all of the nifty tweaks applied to it and should work out of the box. And it's up to you whether that's something you want to do. I tend to configure my own messengers and stuff, even Windows Live Messenger and stuff. I'll tend to set all that up myself because I know what's been done to it and I know how it should behave, which means I, of course, keep both pieces when it breaks. Spyware is stuff that gets information about you and ships it off to remote websites without your permission, usually advertisers because they want that sort of information. Sometimes they could come onto your computer if you click a pop-up or if you download software. I mean, how many people have seen ads on websites that go, scan your PC now, is your PC running slow or inefficient, get PC pit stop now? I wouldn't, but you could if you wanted to.
I used Exterminate for a while, it was pretty good, but yeah, I don't anymore.
Well, I think PC pit stop is okay, but there's a lot of other ones that aren't, and...
Yeah, a lot of...
People have had trouble with things like Registry Mechanic doing horrible things to their registry. And some people who swear by Registry Mechanic, so it just depends on who you talk to. Adware is stuff that is going to get the user to potentially spend money. And obviously they often do it by initially giving you a free program and then suckering you in. Pop-up windows run in front of the browser. although the pop-up blockers have cut that down a lot. Or, of course, if you use NoScript, which Drew is in love with, you can probably disable pop-ups as well. So if you want to be like Drew and you want NoScript for Firefox, you can certainly do that. NoScript. Right, okay, good. Now, and there's also AdBlock Plus. It'll also block ads and stuff that you can have. And I like AdBlock Plus. It's kind of cool. Although, be aware that some of your banking sites and stuff that do require session cookies and stuff will need to be added to the NoScript / AdBlock exception list. And if you're doing surveys and stuff, ad blocking is not a cool thing to do because the survey sites want you to watch the ads. And they won't give you stuff if you don't look at their ads.
Lots of sites actually need to be put on the whitelist, but...
And pop-unders are things that come up sort of when you go to close the browser window and you close all your windows and you find you've got one that's offered you $200 at a casino and you can just start playing right there if you're that sort of person. I tend to close those windows as well, but they will pop up behind other windows. Okay, spam and bulk email. We talked about that a bit earlier. Spam is a name for unsolicited commercial email or unsolicited email, named after the stuff that you buy in a can. And if you're Monty Python, you can start singing spam, 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 if that's something you want to do. Often some people have more problems with spam than others, and there are various ways of fighting that spam. You can either block sender, provided you don't get too big a block senders list, or you can have things like RBL, which is the blacklist lookups, that can look up various spam blacklists and stop spam from coming in, stop spam from being delivered from dial-up accounts or from China. Sadly, I've also discovered that if you block Yahoo.com and Hotmail.com, much to the annoyance of some of your friends, that will also cut down an incredible amount of spam. Okay, Barracuda Spam Blocker. Well, there's also another one called Mime Sweeper. And Zero Spam and a few other things. They all work fairly well. Norton Internet Security has a spam filter thing in it, and I think AVG Internet Security, if you're using POP, has spam filters and stuff in it. Some people swear by them. Some people swear at them. An open relay is a machine that will accept email from anywhere on the internet and send it to anywhere else on the internet. There are still open relays in 2010. They are a bad idea because spammers will just use your machine to relay piles and piles and piles of email to other people and make it look as though it came from you. So don't have an open relay if you can help it. This means that if you're going to set up a 10.4 GoodBuddy little email server on your Windows box, why you would do this, I have no idea. But if you insist on doing it and you're going to open up an SMTP server, make sure it is not an open relay. Email servers should be running on a reasonable platform and usually should be running on server systems rather than home PCs. Home email servers tend to be a little bit of a security risk, especially if security things are discovered. There are builds of things like XM for Windows and stuff, but I'm not talking about that sort of stuff. I'm talking about like my first mail server or whatever.
With regard to how effective spam is, in Australia there's a court case going on now where I think it was 2 in 1,000 people replied and actually paid money to the spammers.
And there is all sorts of legislation that says that if you do spam and that, there's the Can Spam Act. Ha, ha, ha. Okay? We're all in stitches, but it's called the Can Spam Act. And it's meant to cut down on spam by offering fines and stuff to the spammers, provided you can catch them. And I think in this case, they actually did catch some of them. But it can be difficult to actually track down who the spammers are. Also note that infected computers can send out spam. If your computer gets compromised, it can often shovel out spam onto other people and stuff. And that's why stuff can appear to be from somebody you know. Anybody remember the Melissa word virus that used to bounce around via email?
In fact, a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, I read an article, and it was a Microsoft executive that was really, really coming down hard on the people that did not monitor their computers. And he was saying that the people that have infected computers should really be treated as if they had any other kind of disease, and their computers should be quarantined.
Interesting. I mean, some people have some very strong feelings on security. Sometimes people also believe that... Actually, does anybody remember a few months back that somebody came out with a crack for one of the older versions of one of our favorite screen readers, JAWS for Windows, and that crack had a horrible virusy trojany thing in it. And a lot of the antivirus companies were saying that that really wasn't a cool thing to do, to exploit blind users like that.
Probably a blind user who did it, though.
I think I know who it was.
Yes.
We think we do too.
Yeah. It's not good when you have people spoofing as you and sending embarrassing email messages to all your friends.
It did.
Apparently, I have a Saint Bernard that you wouldn't believe, and that message has been deleted from the archives, and it was not sent by me. So, and we do apologize for anybody. There were actually some people who honestly believed that I sent that message out to the lists, and it wasn't me.
Including the boss.
Yeah, well, it was before his first coffee.
That's awkward.
All I can say is for anybody who's thinking that that is hilariously funny, we can spoof email from you too. So just keep that in mind, okay? And we won't, because that would be illegal. But we certainly could. And I don't have a Saint Bernard. But that's beside the point. And as anybody will remember from that particular incident, there were a whole stack of blindness lists that were under attack and were getting those messages injected onto them. Okay, security policy is important to minimize the risk and manage the threats. So you come up with a policy for your organization, what is going to happen to prevent these security things from being a problem? How are people going to limit the number of security attacks and stuff? For example, some workplaces have a policy on no flash drives. Oh no, how are we supposed to hand around that screensaver that after 20 minutes of operation uses up 100% of CPU and corrupts the company database? But some workplaces have a no flash drive policy, or a no removable hard drive policy, or a no laptops policy. Which means, technically speaking, all of these blind people carrying around their little netbooks and stuff are a security risk. And I have actually been in situations where people have said, no, you cannot put your laptop onto our network.
I remember someone, I can't remember if it was some huge media outlet over here, got some foreign correspondent plugged their laptop into the corporate network and had a virus on it, and then within the weekend, the whole network is down. All of a sudden, there's this huge story about, viruses are a serious problem!
I always love the way that your story voice is about 10 times louder than your regular voice.
I'm a very boisterous, bombastic person.
We've noticed. Okay. There's this silly ad on the radio where they're talking about advertising a fish and chip shop, but that's not relevant, so let's move on. Okay, authentication policy, password policy, and stuff. So, for example, physical security, are you required to sign in when you walk into the building? Are you required to sign out when you leave the building? All that sort of thing. Incident handling policies, what are you going to do to the person who is... Or when a virus gets into the system or gets in from a particular PC. Obviously it's not cool to sort of take the person out and code red them, so to speak, but you do need to perhaps have that person's PC quarantined and talk to that person and scan their flash drives if you can figure out who it is, and also how, what sort of time restrictions and stuff are you going to have for bringing the systems back online after a virus has infected them? What sort of backup procedures and stuff do you have for that sort of eventuality? Users must agree to this policy, and the policy must be written down. Anybody notice that when you signed up to the Netacad site, and probably not many people read it, but there was a whole stack of conditions of use that you probably should have read but didn't, that told you about what you were and what you weren't supposed to do on the Netacad site. You agreed to them. Did anybody actually read? I actually did read my copy, but did anybody actually read the terms and conditions of Netacad.net, or were we all
I'm pretty.
Hurry?
I think I read, but I can't remember what I read. Was there anything particularly interesting?
No.
Yeah.
Unlike Microsoft, they do not threaten to disable. Yeah, that's fine. Generally, Microsoft, for example, in one of their user license agreements, tell you that if they detect any pirated material on your computer, they can actually prevent your PC from playing back media content. But we all agreed to that too. Security policy also includes physical access policy, and that is, for example, to prevent users from getting access to wiring closets and routers and stuff, because you don't want all your servers and stuff to be messed around with by the users. Acceptable use policy says what users can and can't do on the network. What sites you can browse, what sites you can't browse. There are certain workplaces, and it upset a lot of the employees, but for example, they blocked Facebook at a law firm that a friend of mine works for, and they were really upset about it. But it's like, no, you guys shouldn't be on Facebook at work. MySpace is another one. YouTube is another one. And in fact, if you are using OpenDNS or your workplace is doing OpenDNS, there are a whole stack of categories that you can set up that will allow you to block different levels of annoyances. So you can either block just the real annoyances that are going to steal users' personal information and stuff, or you can actually block things like Facebook and YouTube. For home users, OpenDNS is free, and you can pay a few dollars a year to get an enhanced account. I think I've got one of the enhanced accounts for the home use. That's for a single IP, and for a work network, you can actually pay money and use OpenDNS and block all sorts of threats, which is something you can certainly do. Remote access policy. Go ahead.
Sorry, aren't threats like spam, etc., becoming worse, or are the tools to damp them down becoming so good that spam's dying?
I would say that spam adapts to the tools that are coming out to block it. The same holds true for viruses and stuff. There's always a war between the antivirus makers and virus makers and the antivirus program writers to keep ahead of the viruses. Just out of interest, for anybody who's been following my saga, Vipper just got taken off my computer last night because it slowed it down and it was horrible. So I have no idea what's going to go on there. I'm going to probably put AVG Free back on. But on my computer, I'm not happy with Vipper. But Grace, Viper, I should say, but Grace likes hers.
Have you tried the new, I hate to say this, have you tried the new Nord?
No, it's probably not too bad, but I don't really want to pay for it because I can get Nod 32 cheaper from my friend who's a reseller.
Fair enough. Not 32 is pretty good too. That's right.
Okay. Network maintenance procedures is where the technicians are going to say how the stuff is going to be maintained, when it's going to be maintained, and what your sort of outage windows and uptime guarantees are going to be. So you got tools that you tend to use for this, software patches and updates, pretty obvious. Anybody played with the Windows Updates Downloader? It's this utility that can make a CD that'll apply all of the critical updates to your Windows box. Very handy, and it works with Windows 7.
Heard of it.
Windows Updates Download. You go grab it and you set it up and you tweak a couple of configuration files and you run it, and then it makes an ISO image that you can burn to CD or DVD that if you drop it into a machine, it will apply all of the missing critical updates and patches, including service packs, to the Windows box.
Nifty.
Sometimes you've got spyware protection. That's always useful. There are better things than spyware, Spybot Search and Destroy. I believe a lot of people are happy with Malwarebytes, which I think has now partnered with Viper. Spam blockers, they're always useful. Pop-up blockers, yes, most browsers have those built into them these days. You used to be able to get add-ons to stop that separately, but generally the functionality is in the browsers. But there are probably also all sorts of plugins and things that will change the behavior of those sorts of things in various browsers. See NoScript plugin for Firefox. And firewalls, which can stop unwanted network traffic either coming in or going out from your network. Patches fix problems, updates add functionality potentially. It is important to keep your software up to date. I think we've covered that in previous lectures. Viruses can slow down computers and cause data corruption. It is important to keep viruses off computers where possible. Keep your antivirus stuff up to date. Signs you have a virus. Computer starts acting abnormally. Program doesn't respond to mouse or keystrokes. Program starting or shutting down on their own. Email program begins sending out large quantities of email. That's one. CPU usage is very high. No, that just meant you installed the latest version of JAWS. There are an unidentifiable or large number of processes. See previous point. Computer slows down significantly or crashes. Well, yes, what can I say? That could be the case of a virus. Or you're running some beta version of something, or you've just put in a new screen reader. Sometimes your antivirus software, if you're using POP, can check incoming and outgoing email for threats. Generally speaking, though, if you're using IMAP, I haven't seen many that do it for an IMAP server. They only tend to do it with POP, which is kind of a drag. Incidents need to be reported to network admin. That seems pretty straightforward, but it is here in the notes. If you get a virus, you should probably go and tell somebody. We actually had this work experience kid that managed to trash the entire web space on one of the ISPs that we were working for. And he was sitting at his computer for about 15 minutes going, oh, crud, oh, crud, oh, crud, oh, crud, until the boss finally came over and said, what is the problem? And he's like, I just managed to delete the entire web tree, and I was just trying to figure out how to get it back. We ended up pulling the information back from the backups, but he was severely scolded and told that he should have told us 15 minutes earlier so that we didn't have the barrage of support calls that were saying, my website isn't working. Somebody's keyed up.
Yeah, what is that?
Somebody's
like
breathing?
Somebody fell asleep.
That's amazing. Somebody's breathing into their microphone. Yes, it's you. There we go. Okay, that was interesting. Okay, anti-spam software can block spam so that it isn't as much of a problem. I think we've gone through that. These are the things that people should do. It's not necessarily the people, things that people will do. Apply application and operating system updates when available. That would be good. There are some people, however, who have a problem with Windows Genuine Advantage and they are unable to apply updates. And that is a problem in itself. And I usually try and send those people out to get a proper copy of the operating system. Run an antivirus program regularly and keep it up to date. Do not forward suspect emails. I actually saw a really good quote that says, if an email says forward this to all your friends, please forget that I am your friend. And I think that's a wonderful quote. Do not open email attachments, especially from people you don't know, or especially attachments that you don't trust. Set up rules in your email program to delete spam that bypass the spam filters and stuff. Yes, Outlook Express and Thunderbird and stuff has some very cool rules and stuff that you can set up, and if you actually put in the time to learn how to use those rules, you can save yourself a lot of grief. Identify sources of spam and support, report it to the network administrator or report it to the owners of that provider. And you can also report incidents to the governmental agency that if there's lots and lots of spam, you can actually report it to various people and they will look into it and see what they can do about it. How many times have you got a virus email that says the St. Bernard virus will activate on the 32nd of May and will wipe out all of your data? Be aware of the St. Bernard virus. This is one that McAfee and staff haven't told you about. So lucky I forwarded this email to you, huh? Okay, some of these emails are legitimate and a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are just people just hitting forward because they saw something that they thought was a threat and it sort of bounces around like one of those internet chain letters. The other problem you can have is a whole lot of, if people have probably seen these, the amazing stories that travel around the internet that can be debunked by a quick look on Snopes.com. Like the one about where you, if you wake up in a bath full of ice and a thing on your chest saying call 000, which I don't know how you'd read it unless it was in Braille, you probably should because somebody's taken your kidneys out. Stuff like that. People are gullible. They will forward that stuff around the place. Try not to. It may have happened, but always go and have a look on Snopes.com and see if it's a real threat or not before you go forwarding it to everybody in your address book. Anyone got anything they want to add to any of that?
I'm good.
We're glad to hear it. Spybot Search and Destroy, which I've spoken about, which is a free one that works fairly well, although a lot of people prefer Malwarebytes and have their other spyware program of choice. You can have on-demand scan, which is a scan that you set that scans when it needs to. Sorry, on-demand scan is one that you actually tell it to scan. You can have an email scanner, and you can have a resident scanner, which scans stuff in memory. They're generally the three types of different scans that the virus programs have. Okay, firewalls limit traffic flow to and from a network. A firewall is named after the device that usually stops fires spreading in buildings, which is a firewall that's usually a very thick wall that is supposed to stop the fire from spreading. There is also a firewall between the engine and the passenger compartment, which is supposed to stop the heat from the engine singeing the passengers in the front. They limit connections into the internal network with packet filters. Also, stateful packet inspection means that only legitimate traffic that is generally meant to come back into the network makes it back into the network, which is usually a reply to traffic that was sent out from the network. Firewalls often perform network address translation. There is often a network address translation module as part of the firewall. Now, an appliance firewall is a firewall that is built into a special network device, such as one of those hardware appliances, Sonic Wall, or those sorts of things, or a Cisco PIX, just to keep our sponsors, so to speak, in the loop here. So there are server-based firewalls that run on things like a network operating system, such as Linux or OS X, or Windows. There's an integrated firewall where a firewall is actually part of the router, and a lot of routers have a firewall. Often they say they have a natural firewall because of the NAT, which is not what natural means. It means network address translation. Because the PCs on the internal network use private IP addresses, you will tend to have a natural firewall because people can't connect to the NATed computers from the outside unless you have port forwarding rules to allow that. A personal firewall runs on a workstation and is not designed to protect like a whole network. It's only designed to protect a particular computer. Do not use more than one personal firewall at a time. They will tend to fight with each other, and they will slow your system down. Same goes for antivirus software. Okay, and I think I'll stop there because we're just about coming up on 11 o'clock, and I will finish the firewall stuff off next week before Grace does her Module 9, because it won't take that long.